Good afternoon, since it's now is afternoon. Welcome to the session, We Did It and So Can You, Tackling Electronic Records Issues. Organizations in all sectors and of all sizes are faced with electronic records issues that need attention now, before records are lost. And this session will detail how three very different organizations address three different issues. Now, you may not agree completely with the approaches that were used or the results and how things were done that are presented today. However, we hope that through this session, we'll be able to provide some practical examples of what some organizations are doing right now to address their electronic records issues, while archivists and records managers wait for the results of the larger or more substantially funded programs, such as the NARA Electronic Records Archives, or ERA program. My name is Rosemary Pleva Flynn. I am the librarian and manager of library information services at the Energy and Environmental Research Center, University of North Dakota. And I'm going to serve as your chair, and I will provide some comments at the end. We have three speakers today. Edie Jeter. Edie is from the International Mission Board and has been the archivist there since 1986. In addition to her regular responsibilities that span all aspects of archival work, Edie has led or co-led on several special projects, including the AutoArc database that she will be describing today. She has several publications, including the IMB Thesaurus, the most recent edition is the 16th, published in 2006, and then several other books that she has written. Our second speaker is Bonnie Weddle. Bonnie is employed at the New York State Archives, where she first worked as a consultant in 1998, and today now works as the Archives and Records Management Specialist 2, has done this since 2004, working with the State Archives on electronic records issues. Bonnie has done a few workshops, including Documentary Heritage Program with the Rochester Regional Library Council called Keeping IT Real, Preserving Electronic Records, which was a workshop for loan arrangers. And at the Mid-Atlantic Regional Archives Conference in 2005, she co-developed and co-presented Electronic Records, Preservation and Access for archivists working in nonprofit and academic repositories. And then our third speaker, and we are perhaps the first SAA session with two Bonnies on our panel, is Bonnie Smith. Bonnie is the corporate archivist for the Aerospace Corporation out in California, where she has been since 2003. There, which is the project she'll be describing today, she was served as co-project lead for their technical report and memoranda conversion project. Before that, she was an archivist and historian with the Indyne Incorporation, where she worked at the John H. Glenn Research Center, part of NASA, in Cleveland, as part of the Centennial of Flight Action Team, developing an online exhibit and web presence related to the celebration for the Century of Flight. This session is being recorded, so in order to make sure we do everything right and everything works well, we're going to have all of our speakers present. I'll provide my comments, and then we're going to save the questions until the end. At the time of questions, I'll be repeating the question, and our panelists will answer those.
The International Mission Board is an agency of the Southern Baptist Convention and was founded in 1845. Today, we have nearly 6,000 field personnel serving around the world. For administrative purposes, we have divided the world into 11 regions. And if you take the average, that gives each region about 545 family units that they need to track. And so you can imagine the amount of information generated, because they need to know where everyone is at every minute of the day. They need to follow their financial records, their ministry records, and so the field, the 11 regions around the world, are responsible for gathering and creating documents that they send. Now, Richmond is our headquarters, and for a period of time, we were decentralized. The regions were keeping their records overseas, but we found that the regions were not filing those records, and so when they needed something, they came to Richmond. And so there was a big discrepancy in what we could provide for them and what they thought we should be able to provide. Archives and records, our mission is to serve as the corporate memory of the International Mission Board by acquiring, organizing, preserving, and providing access to all IMB institutional and missionary records. There were obstacles to the ARM mission, and that included the decentralized overseas administration, the rotating Richmond regional staff, and technology. I'm just doing an intro first. Now, I'm giving you a quick background because I want you to know the frustration that led to this AutoArt project. In 1993, we had 107 boxes of missionary correspondence transferred to our archives in Richmond. By 1997, which was our watershed year for several reasons, we had 157 boxes. It was watershed because it is the year that we moved our Richmond regional offices from Richmond to the field. We began to move from a VAX VMS environment to an NT environment. We had a proliferation of e-documents that were being filed on people's hard drives and nowhere else. In 2001, we had 23 boxes of correspondence transferred to the archives. And so in 1997, when IT asked me what I wanted, I said, when we create our new system, we need to have a way to capture email. And they looked at me and they said, oh, that's a great idea, not possible. And so technology was an obstacle, but actually technology was really the answer to our question, because when I was hired as archivist 20 years ago, I came in 1 month into my job and they said, oh, and we're giving you this system and you are going to lead it and you are going to develop it. And it was a Battelle system called BASIS. BASIS has undergone many, many changes, many owners. It is now a part of OpenText LiveLink. It is just a product. We have migrated that system six times since 1986. So, BASIS provided research, retrieval, full-text capability searching. It was web-enabled. We had 18 applications already in it, and it had both intranet and intranet capability when we decided to pursue an email project. So automating archives. Our idea was to develop an automated email repository to ensure the documentation of Southern Baptist International missions. I looked at people and I said, well, we have an email. You know, why can't we just provide that as an, you know, so many of our regions were saying, we have so much email on our hard drives, we don't know how to find anything. And so they were buying email organizers. And I thought, we have a system already in place, Solomon. I will tell you a funny story. We renamed Solomon. It is BASIS. But whenever you ask anyone at the board if they liked BASIS, they said, oh, I hate that system. And so we just called it Solomon when we did one of our migrations, and they love it. They love it. So it really has been beneficial to rename certain products. So our challenge, I was talking to IT and I said, we need an email system. We are not getting any information. And they said, until you get executive support, we are not going to go anywhere. We won't even talk to you. So I had a researcher come from Indonesia. He was looking for information from 1990 to 2000. And we had 10 file folders for that decade. I went to our executive vice president who worked in Indonesia. I said, this is all we have. All we have on Indonesia work for 10 years. I said, we have got to do something. All of that is out on somebody's PC somewhere. And he said, I will fund your project. This is a hallway conversation. I run to IT. And I said, he will fund our project. And we had already scheduled a Solomon migration. And we needed to do that because we needed a batch capability for loading the documents. And so we got $15,000 from IT. We had $15,000 from our executive vice president. I operate on a budget of about $5,000 to $7,000 a year. I had $2,000 left in my account, and I said, you can have it all. And so the I'm getting way ahead of myself. So we had close to $32,000. The project was completed in less than the amount of time. We had 1 year to do it. We completed it in 6 months, and we came in $3,000 under budget. So everybody was quite happy with it. So our solution was we were going to marry our Solomon full-text retrieval database with our email for, for a system called AutoArc. And how we arrived at AutoArc, I said, I don't want to have to do anything to this email coming in, because our regional people would say, oh, we get 10, 20,000 emails a year. And I thought, well, I don't want to deal with any of that. So I said, I need something that is totally automated that's for the archives. And so our IT called it AutoArc, and I thought, we'll go with it. So basically, there are select field personnel and home office staff, because the executive vice president liked it so much when he saw the prototype that he said he wanted to have a piece of this as well. So select field personnel and home office staff, determine if the content of the e-document is archival based on an archives and records management protocol, which is basically our retention schedule for the regions. They determine the security level. This is not a change. This always happened with our paper documents, too. They chose what they were going to send to archives, so it's no different. They forward the email documents that they create or receive in the normal course of business. They file the e-documents on their PC. This is what we hope they do for 6 months, and then they delete it, and then they can research the information online. I know for a fact that some of our regions do follow this. They keep it 6 months, some keep it 3 months, and some verify that it's in the database and delete it. So this is a picture of my inbox, and if you can note at the top, next to the help, it's there are three icons, envelope, email, So we name them white, blue, and green for different security purposes. Really, the blue level is really a retrieval piece, because we wanted to have a way that our top executive management could get to everything without having to go from region to region. The database is one database. It has multiple models for each region and each home office that is represented. So basically what you do is you highlight a document, you click one of the icons, and it goes to an inbox. So the transaction, e-documents from IMB Home Office and 11 regional offices are forwarded to a central inbox. The inbox validates all e-documents on four criteria. The email addresses, and you can have 1 or 100 email addresses. You just have to give them all to us. They're your name. The click of that icon embeds a recognition string into the document, into the subject line, and then envelope security level. The e-documents are done in batch during the nightly IT routine. E-documents that meet all four criteria are then moved to a processed folder, and then e-documents that fail to meet any of the criteria are then moved to a rejected folder, and I review that each morning. If you look at the bottom of that screen, you'll see a mailbox down at the bottom that says 94 in the inbox. There are 74 that have been processed and 4 that have been rejected. In a year and a half that we've had this up and going, we have only had 4 documents rejected that we cannot figure out why they've been rejected. There have been others that have not given us all of their email addresses, but only 4 that we cannot figure out what to do with. So this is a copy of the report I get every morning, and basically it says that the night before that there were 106 in the inbox and that they were processed. So the user profiles are determined by either the home home office VP or by the regional administrative associate, you can have one of three profiles. You can have send and retrieve, you can have send only, and you can have retrieve only privileges. We had the biggest discussion is what should we send, because of course not every financial record needs to be in the archives forever. And so we looked at their retention schedule and we pulled out some highlights. And so we said, you know, if you've got regional correspondence or RL reports to the Vice President of the Office of Overseas Operations, regional strategies, if you've got conference agendas or workshops that you have done on the field, if you have correspondence from your field personnel, their goals and objectives, or if they've written a strategy report, if you have financial records dealing with properties or taxes or information on government agencies, or because we have a lot of passport and visa work that we need to do, or if you have regional reports to our trustee committees, we want those. We also want your legal documents coming in, correspondence, contracts, copyrights, because our regions are involved in a lot of publications overseas. And then ministry information. We want what we tell them. We do not want financial records. We want to tell the story of what our missionaries are doing around the world and what we were getting, for the most part, in paper were any documents that came in that required receipts. So medical bills. We had tons of medical bills, but very little else. And so these were the kinds of things that they are sending. Security levels are assigned based on the content of the e-document or the security of the personnel on the field. We have some people who are in highly secure regions of countries, and so they are assigned a Security 3 level. So if you're dealing with Security 3 personnel, you would pick the highest security envelope to send their information. And security level is selected when e-documents are forwarded to the AutoArc, and that determines the retention or the security for the retrievals. So if someone has a white security level retrieval, that's all they can retrieve, anything that was sent with a white envelope. If you are a regional leader or if you are the president of the International Mission Board, you have access to everything in every model of the database through a DBA level. Just so you could see a little bit clearer, the three envelopes that are at the top of your of my email screen. This next slide, I just had to include it because this is what our IT department drew so that you would understand everything about AutoArc. So basically, we have personnel who have icons installed on their email. They choose one, or you can choose 100, it's your choice, of the documents. You click an icon, it's sent to a central inbox. At night during the IT routines, they are uploaded, batch, based on their region. And then every night, there is also a nightly backup. So the e-documents are transferred to AutoArc according to the office procedure. Home office staff and field personnel are encouraged to delete their copies of the e-document. We would like it once it's in AutoArc. E-documents will be maintained indefinitely in the system, and for preservation purposes, email documents, e-documents, will be transferred to microfilm on an annual schedule. So quickly, the retrieval process. You have to have personnel, field or home office, have to have a valid Solomon user ID and password to retrieve information from AutoArc. Personnel log into Solomon through an internal IMB web portal with secure connection, and personnel select the AutoArc application and the specific regional model. This is our intranet screen, and you can see at the top there are applications and Solomon. And then these are the different applications that we have currently available for our home office staff and field personnel. And when you select AutoArc, then you see that you have Central Asia, Central and Eastern Europe, Central, Eastern, and Southern Africa, the different regions that we have prescribed for our world. Solomon, username and password. And those are computer-generated. You don't get a choice, and they are ugly. Ugly. No one can remember them except I think I can remember mine only because I have to log in so many different places. So basically, this is the search form for AutoArc, and so I'm searching my test data. I have a database that I'm eventually going to name Archives because I've got so many research requests in here. And so I'm searching for the term copyright. And so you can see that the result set, it's the information that is collected is addressed to the sender, the regional code, the security, and the document type. The subject line is on the second line, so it's copyright versus ownership, and you can see that there is a secure string that's embedded into each document. And then if you'll notice, there is the little icon, the hit-to-hit scrolling that allows you to go through the different documents when you read the records. This is our advanced search screen, and so I can search on who the email was addressed to, or the sender, or the security, the sent date. There is also a sent to archives date. We do date stamp everything that comes into the database. And then you can search text. And so again, I'm just doing the same copyright search, but I'm searching where I am the sender. And so there are three. And copyright is highlighted in the subject line because that was what I was searching. And then my name is highlighted under the sender. And so again, there is information here. The issue was on copyright, not that I knew that I was going to attend a copyright session, but we like to provide as much information as we can to our personnel, and there was another agency that said, what about copyrights? And I said, we like to share as much information as we can. If we can give it out, we do. And so we don't worry when people are asking to use our data. So challenges, the evolving technologies, our upgrades to new systems, and will AutoArc remain compatible? PGP files crash the database. We did try those. And so we have a huge amount of PGP files that we need to find a solution for. Zip files are also, they do not, Solomon does not have the capability to unzip those files. And so although it stores them and they can be retrieved, they are not searchable. XML and other formatting, sometimes it comes out a little skewed, and so we have to look at that as well. And then the biggest effort is the backlog. We have people who are walking around with laptops that have documents back to 1990. So the conclusion is we attempted to parallel our IMB paper system. Users still control what documents are sent to the archives. The data is dumped annually to microfilm by region and then date descending chronological order. And so the life cycle of our email is complete. And thank you.
I beg your indulgence. I've been talking so much over the past 3 days that my voice is starting to go, so it's definitely time for me, at least, to go home. Over the next few minutes, I am going to discuss how the New York State Archives is rebuilding its capacity to preserve the electronic records that have been and are being transferred to us. I use the present tense, rebuilding, for a couple of reasons. First, as we all know, the rate of change in the world of electronic records is such that none of us has the luxury of standing still. Second, this really is a progress report. The old saw that any technology project takes far longer than you ever thought imaginable. Well, we've had some experience with that. But at any rate, once that I have outlined the steps that we've taken to date and how we chose to act as we did, I'm going to detail some of the short and long-term goals that remain before us. I have to stress at the outset, reiterating what Rosemary said, that some of the specific choices that we've made may not be appropriate for all repositories. If you're using PON, if you have data grids, we're definitely not for you. I should also emphasize that most of my comments do concern records that we've already identified as archival. I have a number of colleagues who schedule and appraise state agency records, provide training and guidance to state agency records creators. To date, I really haven't been actively involved in those activities. I think that may change in the future, but at the present, I'm really focused on stuff that we already have or are likely to get in the near future. Finally, I'm just going to touch on a few of the things that we've been doing. We've got a lot of irons in the fire, but today I'm just going to pull only a few of them out. To give you a bit of background, the New York State Archives is part of the State Education Department. We have approximately 50 professional archival and records management positions at present. Not all of them are filled. And we hold more than 100,000 cubic feet of paper and approximately 150 gigabytes of electronic records. We also provide a variety of services to state agencies, local governments, and historical records repositories throughout the state. We have a rather lengthy history of working with electronic records. We began researching electronic records issues and appraising electronic series in 1985, and in 1990 we established the Center for Electronic Records, which accessioned a number of large data sets, researched state agency record-keeping practices, and provided training and guidance to state agency records creators. Owing to staff departures and a prolonged period of fiscal hardship, the Center for Electronic Records was gradually dismantled in the mid-1990s. Our local government program, which had a dedicated funding stream, was able to continue researching electronic records issues and prepared a series of workshops and publications on the subject, but most of our other electronic records activities gradually came to a halt. Fortunately, about 3 years ago, the situation improved considerably, and constraints on hiring and equipment purchase were eased. In spring 2003, State Archives Senior Management established the Electronic Records Team, which is a cross-organizational body charged with planning to rebuild our capacity to manage and preserve electronic records. In summer 2004, the team's ranks grew to include a staffer who was appointed to the new position of Electronic Records Archivist, and she's standing here before you today. I've actually been at the State Archives since 2000, working in another capacity. As our planning process began in earnest, the Electronic Records Team was guided by three principles that came out of our past experience. First, we were going to take custody of a growing number of electronic records. In years past, we had explored the possibility of allowing agencies that had both the will and the capacity to preserve their own records to do so, but we determined that in most instances, agencies lacked the requisite motivation and resources. Sooner or later, and preferably sooner, we were going to have to step into the breach. Second, we had to be results-oriented and practical. Obviously, if we were going to take custody of records, it was incumbent upon us to ensure that they survived. In addition, we had to produce results that we could point to when asking for future increases in technology and staff. We've had success with this kind of incremental approach in the future and hope and expect that it will work again. Third, electronic records tasks would be divided between existing work units. We just don't have the staff to create a separate electronic records unit at this point, and we knew from past experience just how vulnerable a separate unit could be. Moreover, we were convinced that setting up a separate unit would, in essence, declare that we expected to remain a paper-centered repository with electronic records work tacked on at the end. And this was not our vision of the future, either for ourselves or for the profession as a whole. We don't expect every archivist to become an electronic records expert, but we do expect that each archivist will have basic knowledge about records regardless of format. For example, an accessioning archivist should be able to take in both paper and electronic records, identify any obvious problems, know when to call on colleagues, know when those records can move through accessioning and on to processing. Finally, as we began researching digital preservation strategies and technology issues, we identified a fourth principle. Every single piece of equipment that we purchased would need to be replaced in 3 to 5 years. I very strongly lean toward three. And every piece and every policy that we developed would need to be reevaluated in 3 to 5 years. Again, I lean toward three. We spent a lot of time doing research during the early development stages, and I have to emphasize that that research was very practically oriented. We did look at the Open Archival Information System reference model and on the work on authenticity done by Inter Pares and a host of other theoretical things, but we spent most of our time examining how other archives were applying this theoretical knowledge in the real world. In other words, what we were doing was looking for best practices. For example, when looking at preservation strategies, we very quickly zeroed in on conversion to open source or at the least fully documented formats, which at the present is the most common approach, and there is a solid community of practice out there. There's certainly a range of disagreement within that community, but there's certainly a network of people using similar approaches, identifying common problems and common solutions. In addition, we were looking for models that we could adopt and modify to meet our own needs and circumstances. And the best example of this process of adoption involves an interplay between hardware, software, and workflows. When we decided that conversion to open formats would be our chief preservation strategy, we began thinking about what kind of equipment and work processes we would need to either purchase or develop in order to make that happen. We started examining how other archives conceptualized their equipment arrays and the degree to which we could follow in their footsteps. We ultimately focused upon the preservation model developed by the National Archives of Australia, which has three freestanding open source equipment arrays. First, there's a quarantine station that's used to check records against transfer documentation, perform antivirus checks, and generate checksums used for error detection purposes. Second, there's a preservation station that's used for any needed conversion work. NEA's preservation model is very much XML-centered. Ours isn't at this point, but the model is flexible enough to accommodate that difference. Finally, there's a storage station used to store both original bitstream and converted versions of all files, and to generate backup copies stored off-site. One of the things that we really liked about the NEA model is that in many ways it parallels our existing division of labor. Quarantine station tasks mesh quite well with those already being performed by our accessioning staff, and preservation station tasks are, in many respects, analogous to those currently performed by our collections management staff. As a result, staff should be able to see how their new electronic records work relates to their existing responsibilities and feel more comfortable with their new assignments. Another thing that we really liked about the NEA model was its scalability. A station could consist of a desktop computer, a mammoth storage area network, or just about anything in between. We were looking for a number of reasons to start small and then grow as needed. First of all, we lacked hands-on experience. All of our Center for Electronic Records folks had departed, and there were some real gaps in institutional memory. Second, and I could be very wrong about this, I hope I'm not, we don't anticipate any large, complex transfers, at least in the immediate future. We're currently talking with a number of agencies about tackling email, geographic information systems, and the like, but I suspect that it's going to take at least a couple of years for these discussions to result in any actual transfers. Finally, our parent agency's IT department has a finite amount of resources. IT staff have consistently been supportive and open to suggestion, but they've also made it plain that, for example, they just can't support an open source environment at this time. They were also initially reluctant to allow us to keep any of our equipment off of the agency network, which is something that we wanted to do for security purposes. However, we were able to work out a compromise on this particular issue. Our quarantine station is connected to the agency network so that IT can force upgrades of the antivirus and the other software, but our preservation and storage stations aren't. We're not wild about these compromises, and we'll certainly revisit them in the future, but we recognize that we had to accept them in order to move forward. Taking all of these considerations into account, we determined that for the next couple of years, we would focus on managing our current holdings and incoming small transfers. We could then point to these small-scale successes and, most likely, an increasing number of large, complex transfers when making the case for technology upgrades and increases in staff. However, we really didn't need a lot of equipment to accomplish the immediate tasks before us, and so we determined that our initial quarantine and preservation station would consist of desktop computers, and our storage station would consist of a small server. There are some really obvious disadvantages to this setup, but there are also a couple of benefits. First off, our equipment is purchased under state contract, which means that it's compatible with most of the hardware and the software being used by most of our records creators. Second, although the desktops have been customized in some ways, they have second, internal hard drives, they have DVD burners, which until recently were not on staff computers, These computers look and behave almost exactly like the machines that sit in our offices, and as a result, staff don't have to spend a lot of time familiarizing themselves with the technology. There's a comfort level there. So, where are we now? We've purchased equipment, and after a rather complicated chain of events, have the quarantine and preservation desktops up and running, and we're waiting for IT to set up our storage server. That's one of the things that I get to do when I go back to Albany next week. But we are in the midst of moving from planning to doing. At present, we're taking all of the agency-supplied transfer media that's been sitting on our shelves, sometimes for a decade, and copying all of the files to the hard drives of our quarantine computer and producing backup copies for off-site storage. This does a couple of things. First, it reduces the risk that we're going to lose this data. Second, it lays the groundwork for our very next task, which is devising step-by-step accessioning and processing procedures. We need to ensure that all of our electronic records work, all of the work assigned to a given unit is fully integrated into that unit's existing workflows. And as a result, I'll be working with unit staff to develop and test instructions on a unit-by-unit basis. Unit staffers really do have expertise to contribute this process, and it's also important to for them to have a say in shaping the changes that affect their working lives. Staff training is another key goal. Accessioning and processing staff will get a lot of their training as we develop test and document procedures, but other staff really need guidance as well. Everyone needs to have a basic sense of what we're doing so that they can explain it to customers, to researchers. And other staff have specialized needs. For example, staff who do reference need to know enough about our electronic holdings to point users to records of interest, answer basic questions about format and structure, and handle copying requests, so on and so forth. Finally, we've got to improve our access mechanisms. In the past, we've simply provided copies of our electronic holdings on disk. However, we plan to create searchable web interfaces for some of our data sets, and some of our image files are excellent candidates for web presentation. Over the next 2 to 4 years, we're going to be doing a number of things. First off, we'll continue working with agencies to tackle email, GIS systems, and other large and complex records. We're also going to have to start moving from a push model to a pull model of taking in records. In other words, we need to stop waiting for agencies to initiate transfers and develop relationships and mechanisms that allow us to bring in records at predetermined intervals. I suspect that for a host of technical and sociological reasons, this task is going to take a very long time, but it's one that we have to start addressing very soon. As I mentioned earlier, we'll also need to revisit our preservation strategies as best practices change and our electronic holdings grow. Finally, we'll need to design and build a hardware and software array that will allow us to take in, process, and store large quantities of records. This array has to automate a lot of the tasks that we're currently performing manually. And by the way, will somebody please ask me why I think it's a good thing that we start out with so much manual labor? So, what have we learned throughout this process? First, it's important to understand and make use of one's history and organizational culture, even if your aim is to change that culture in some way. The reason we're starting really small is because our ultimate goal, turning ourselves into a repository that handles electronic and paper records with equal dexterity, is so huge. And we need a support and buy-in and a sense of ownership at every level, and those things don't come about overnight. Knowing when to compromise is also important. Some compromises are unacceptable, some are unavoidable, others merely more or less undesirable. Being able to tell the difference is crucial, as is thinking strategically. Will a given compromise put records at risk or somehow otherwise make it impossible to achieve a desired objective? Are there potential benefits? For example, will compromising today earn you goodwill that will stand you in good stead in the future? Finally, it's imperative to strike a balance between the short term and the long term. Every action that we take today must address a long-term goal and serve as a step toward a distant and desired future. At the same time, we have to remain focused on the tasks at hand. The distance between today's circumstances and our future goals can be overwhelming at times, but it's absolutely essential that we keep doing what we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, now we go from the large scale to the small scale. My name's Bonnie Smith, as it was introduced earlier. I am corporate archivist of the Aerospace Corporation, and I have the honor of being what is known in our profession as a one-man band. What I'd like to do is show you what we've done and some very practical things that you can do. I hope that you can take home with you and use in your own shops. What I'd like to do, first of all, is describe a little bit, number one, about our company, and number two, about what we're trying to achieve in two projects that we worked on. And then you have a handout with a list of some of the things that we learned. First of all, this is the Aerospace Corporation. We're 4,000 employees. We do research and development for a variety of federal customers. We're located on both coasts with regional offices. And of course, as you can imagine, we have people all over doing the same projects, and they need instant access to information. Had to do this. You know, I'm kind of a photographic kind of a person, so I had to include to show you a little bit of what we've looked like then and now. Corporation celebrated its 46th anniversary this summer. And, of course, an anniversary is a time to reflect on where you've been, but also to, you know, implement long-range planning. In our corporation, as I mentioned, we have three different focuses that revolves around this. First of all, we have a widely dispersed population. We have a mountain of technical reports that we've produced over the years. Our final product is technical knowledge. And then the third point is we have a staff that is aging, key staff members. They're getting older. They're experts in their field. But there was a concern that there was a lot of information within the corporation that was leaving as the engineers and staff members retired. So about 2.5-3 years ago, we were charged by the administration with the following goal: from anywhere to anywhere. Gee, does that sound familiar? I think everybody in this room has dealt with that in one way or the other. To this end, the company purchased in 2003 a digital document management system. Of course, a document management system like this has to have a buy-in, and it has to be populated with valuable materials to be useful. This gives you an example of one of the projects that we started. Library and archives played a key part in the selection of this document management system, as well as training and management and populating it with technical reports. We chose our first set of records to populate this with as a series of technical reports. You're looking at them here. And we chose an outside vendor to digitize these things. We didn't have the skill sets or the time that was needed. Again, keep in mind that we're doing this with a very small staff, one or two project managers, and support staff, things like summer students and casual employees. So with our vendor, they needed a box level item inventory. And we started, how we chose the documents and how we put together an item level inventory was we went to our library catalog, our OPAC, and built a document form, a database, as you can see here. And in the process, we learned that, yes, we can do this. This is wonderful. We were able to check these documents off as we loaded the documents. But after trial and error, we discovered that it was much easier not only to make a hard copy to put in the front of the boxes, but also to send an electronics copy to the vendor. The vendor was then able to anticipate, build document target sheets as, you know, the traditional barcode that you see for special needs documents. Things like these separated the different documents, but also we had separation sheets. So, you know, a lot of our documents have these oversized data sets, oversized engineering reports, colored photographs, things of that nature in them. So this was a way of rebuilding the documents. These went out to the document system, or went out to the vendor. Then they came back. They had to be rebuilt, reshelved, and checked off the document list. This is where this guy was particularly important, because frequently there'd be things like orphans. There would be things like two documents that were filmed together, put on the same image, things of that nature. We could tell exactly from our document manifest exactly what condition these documents went to the vendor with. So we were able to tell exactly what was going on. This helped in two ways. First of all, it helped us streamline the process on our end of the shop, but it also helped us to identify if there was a pattern, if there was something going on at the vendor level that we could address right up front. The second project we used, or that that I've been working on is a project to capture this corporate memory that I alluded to earlier. These are things, are information that are not part of our formal report system. These are 30-year employees, 40-year employees that are leaving, that are moving offices, and that, you know, they've had terrific careers, they've produced a great amount of work and great amount of valuable resources for the company, but it wasn't captured in a formal report system. To that end, library management formed a special team called the Document Rescue and Recovery Team. The team was built with two senior librarians, two senior reference staff members, and myself as archivist. What we did and what we were charged with was to build a system and to create a list, a method, a plan to capture this memory. This is what the document was that we built. We built a matrix. We went together and figured out, made a list of all the kinds of documents that we created and that we needed over time that we've been using. And then we sent this out to management. We sent this out to project teams. We sent this out to support staff. We asked them, okay, these are the documents that we think are important. This is why we think they're important. Give us your input. This document probably is the most useful piece of equipment that I use on a day-to-day basis. As you can tell by the columns, is this workable in the archives? Does this go to technical services? What happens? In the course of this work, we were able to find that, yes, in fact, there were a lot of things that we did need to add to the library collection because, as a lot of you know, technical reports are created, but they're not always following procedures and they don't always send a copy to the library and archives. We were also able to identify some things that belonged to some of the project offices, as well as some things that, yeah, no, we don't need these things, but we have, you know, where can we finally make a disposition on them? We've done a lot. We've learned a lot from these two projects, and I'd like to give you just a few hints that we've learned along the way. This is on your list, and I'll try and be as brief as I can with this. The very first one, and of course you hear this in every single textbook, ensure the backing of upper management. Yeah, you need the funding. Funding is important, but you also need their active championing. You need somebody to say, hey, we've got this new system, it's got some value, take a look and see what you think. Another thing is to set priorities. Of course, our first set was a set of technical reports. Since then, we've moved on to other sets. Right now, we have something like 48,500 documents that have been converted to digital format. These are our two most valuable sets of technical reports. And then I threw a few historical photographs in because, again, the company doesn't see this as a priority, but the archivist does. Again, that was part of our system, you know, which is most important as a document rescue team. What can provide us with the best use? Again, another reason for my justification of the photographic collection is our 50th anniversary is coming up soon. I suspect somebody's going to want a few of those photographs. Point number three is to have a wish list. Since our company's federal contractors, frequently at the end of the year we'll have something called use or lose money. And at times a project will end up and they may have a couple of $1,000s and they may have funding for supplies or something. And they're not going to be able to use it, but they know, you know, we've got to do something with it. This is where it was really important for us to know exactly what we can do for X amount of dollars on a short term. Number four is to explore ways to partner with other departments. Our first document set was 12,000 records. We worked with an engineering division that was moving. They moved from a large suite of offices to a very small compact system. They had no room for their documents. In this instance, we were able to provide them a means. We provided the manpower. They provided the funding to have these documents converted. We got electronic copies back. They got used copies to use in their office suite. And we were able, to identify some things that we didn't have copies of. The other one is to educate employees and staff. I gave you a real lengthy list here because I knew I wouldn't remember everything to begin with. We're always looking for ways that we can educate staff members, that we can show our staff, oh, gee, this does work. Oh, hey, this is a good idea. We had something that we called sound bites. It was five-minute presentations to senior staff where we'd go into a senior staff meeting and say, let us show you one facet of our new AeroLink program. short presentation and staff meetings. We went to all hands meetings. We went to, you know, have information, we'll travel kind of things. Anytime anyone came into the library and expressed an interest, come see us. We'll show you how it works. We'll give you one-on-one demonstrations. Again, every time we had something new going on, we put an announcement in our corporate intranet. We have a web page, intranet bulletin. And then, of course, we got things in new hire packets. We were included in any new hire briefings, any in orientation sessions. Another point is to prepare detailed work plans. I mentioned earlier that we worked with a small staff and we used a lot of casual and support staff. This is important to go through, pack a box, see how many documents it's going to hold. We all have ballpark figures, but see how many real documents it'll hold with engineering drawings, those kinds of things. Figure out how long it takes, what it's going to take you. This will give you your basis to use for your estimate for your project plan. But also on this is when you're working on this, you're going to have to train other staff. And it's been our experience that you have two or three different work styles. One of them is a college staffer that's used to dealing with records and used to dealing with, you know, filing papers, maybe a, you know, somebody that works in the library, that you can show them how to do it, watch them do it a time or two, and they'll work on their own. There are other staffs that are not familiar and very uncomfortable with it, and if you don't give them a step-by-step-by-step to exhaustive detail, it's going to cost you, because what's happening is they're going to leave a step out, and then you're going to have to spend a whole lot of time going back and fixing what went wrong. The next one is to test each step. As we mentioned, look for ways that you can streamline the process. When you're using a short staff, again, you're going to want to know, okay, is there a better way we can do this? Step number 8 is be open, be flexible. When we're taking our little exhibits around and proving it to the various staff members, we're going to get asked the hard questions. After all, you know, this is outside of their comfort zone. They're going to ask us the hard questions. What about? What do you do if? Know the system, break it. Try and break it, and know what happens when you fix it. And probably number 9 was the one that we learned the most from. Expect the unexpected. I mentioned earlier to pack a box, pack a couple of boxes, learn what it takes to send these things out, learn what kind of steps you need. In our particular instance, it came back to surprises. We were working on these boxes, and because we work for the federal government, we have a lot of classified documents. Over the years, the federal government has allowed us to declassify documents. We don't do it ourselves. The federal government sends us a memo that says you may declassify XYZ type of documents at XYZ intervals. Well, of course, library staff and archive staff, being short-staffed as it was, they put a cover sheet on it. This document has been declassified. Please remove all markings prior to leaving the archives. Well, that works great if you've got 1, 2, or 3 documents going out at a time, or 1, 2, or 3 documents that are going out to be photocopied or put into use at time. Well, what happens when you hit a couple of thousand? In our particular instance, we had several thousand documents that had to be declassified, which means each and every page of each and every document had to have the classification markings removed. That cost us something like 6 to 8 weeks, and we were, again, using everybody we could beg, borrow, or steal. We had what we called scratching parties back in our warehouse to do nothing but remove markings from the documents. Which leads me to another point. Work ahead of schedule. Figure out how much it's going to cost you or how much time it's going to take to box something like this, to create these items, put them together, then add 25% to your estimate. If you absolutely have to cut it to the bare bone, add 10 or 15%, but add as much as you can comfortably add to this estimate, because you're going to run into this. As a sidelight, I might add we're on to like version number 3 of this project, and now we're into something called classified documents. And guess what? We ran into more of these things that have to be remarked, but gee whiz, unlucky us, these are higher level documents that have to be marked as lower level documents. We can't do support staff. They don't have the clearance that's required to remark these things. So it's going to be professional staff that's sitting there with the trustee stamps and the markers remarking these things. Another point that I want to mention, it's a little bit controversial in my shop, but I wanted to give you something to take away with you, what this is going to cost. If you're a single-person shop, figure out what it's going to cost to estimate or to scan one box of documents, then multiply it by 9. Our ballpark figures were something about $150, $160 a box. But think about all the administrative staff that it takes. This is staff that built the database, that built the spreadsheet, that have to box, that have to check them off, that have to rebox, that have to link them to our online public access catalog, because eventually our goal is to be able to pull these documents up related to our online catalog, click, and you're right at the original document itself. As I said, that was a real controversial number in our shop, but at least multiply it by 4 or 5 times to get an actual project number. Another thing that we learned the hard way is learn your vendor's requirements when you're working outside. Learn the quirks of their systems. Learn as much as you can after you've had the contract or after you've gone that way. Or if you're looking for a piece of equipment to bring it in-house, learn the ins and outs of the equipment. Keep in mind what you're going to need. How do they handle these gosh-awful oversized data sets? How do they handle 2-foot by 3-foot engineering drawings? Do they do microfilm? Do they do color prints? All of those things you're going to have to keep in mind as practical things. And then determine what you want as an output and determine what hardware and software you have. For example, another thing that we ran into is we asked for these documents. We received them in JPEG format, which sounds wonderful, except, wait a minute, hold on. We need TIFF formats. We need archival versions of these. And, okay, well, these are such large files. We'll be glad to send those back to you in DVDs. Well, the computer that I have in the archives that are going to be loading these into the system is only a CD-ROM. So keep this in mind when you're writing your specs and when you're writing your document requirements. Add all of these little things. It sounds so simple. It sounds so common sense. But if you don't think about it up front, it's going to come back, and you're going to have to struggle with it. And then keep a running problem list. Again, this crazy thing that I mentioned earlier about marking classified documents. We ran into a lot of little things. We were discovering that there are patterns of errors that we were finding in the things that came back. And so if you keep a running list, you can deal with them on your end at your shop, and you'll have to build some kind of a protocol with the vendor, how to deal this, how to relate this. That's when we learned that it was a whole lot easier to send an electronic version of our manifests up front out to the group. It was a whole lot easier to send it to the vendor ahead of time because it saved them time and it also saved us time and costs in the end run. And last but not least, this is my favorite one, cultivate retiring staff and retiree groups. Working in the archives the way all of us do, I think our retirees are probably our most underrated resource. If you get a list from personnel or if you know of somebody that's about to retire, offer to assist the person. Contact the person before he retires. Offer to assist the person. Ask them if they've got things for the archives. Can you help them when they're working on their offices? This is a win-win format as far as I'm concerned. What happens in this instance is the person that's leaving is going to feel validated. They're going to feel like they've made an important contribution to the company. You're going to get records. You're going to probably find some wonderful things that you wouldn't have any other way. If you're real lucky, they'll come back and help you organize and box and shelve and process the stuff that they've given you. And you've got this kind of support when the things come to you. And often, if it's an upper-level manager or some kind of a manager, they're going to say, oh, yeah, that archives, they're on the ball. Yeah, you need to give them some resources or you need to give them some help. So in concluding, it's a lot of work. It can be done by a very small staff with limited resources. And ultimately, it's quite rewarding. You know, the first time that I sat down and somebody in our Chantilly office said, hey, I could sure use a document that, and I was able to send it to him as an email attachment rather than take 5 days to go down and photocopy it and mail it and so on, it was a great feeling. So we did it. I'm sure you can too. Thank you.
Okay, before we get to questions, my part of the presentation today is to address what you can do right now with your electronic records or in your those issues around them. No matter what size your institution is, what type of institution you are, I recognize a lot of people in our audience have been working with electronic records for years, and I'm sure they will echo some of the things I'm going to say. We've heard some of these same comments in the presentations today, and I've heard them at other sessions already at SAA. Well, we're almost at the end, right? But what I want to do is just share a few things with you as, like, you know, some tips for getting started, things that you need to be aware of. This is not an exhaustive list. Each individual situation is going to require some additional steps. But I wanted to make sure that everybody had some basic things to start with if you're just trying to tackle some of your issues. So what can you do now? First thing you need to do is you need to define your goals and the steps you need to take to achieve them. Now, the very first thing you need to make sure is that the issues you're addressing are really issues. If it's a record that's going to be scheduled for destruction in 7 years, ignore it. Don't worry about it. You're going to have much more important things to be concerned about. And then second, you need to indicate whether your goals are short-term or long-term and how they build on each other. Because this leads into the second point, you need to keep in mind the big picture, but focus your efforts on one part. If you're a small organization, if you're a lone arranger, you've only got a limited amount of time, and so you need to make sure that you can focus on something you can get your hands around, but make sure you remember how it fits into that overall thing that you want to achieve. So you're going to tackle the individual projects to build it into something that's whole. The third point is to understand your processes and your organizational culture. You know, this is something that, you know, a lot of us have talked about over the last few years, that this is particularly important if you want to make a change. You have to know what's happened already and what you want it to be, and you have to be aware that some people aren't going to want to do it. You need to take every opportunity to present what you want others to know to your organization and have them learn the importance of addressing electronic records issues. So if somebody loses that file they've been looking for from their desktop, use that as a learning experience. See, if I had you put this into the archives or you put this into the records management system, you'd still have it. Now, it may take years of groundwork to even get a very small project started. In my particular situation, I've been there now for 4 years, and we're still trying. It's still in Access 97 for just our basic record tracking system. But you keep plugging away. And they need to talk to others in the terms that they understand. You need to learn some of the IT terms. You need to learn terms that management's going to understand, because they don't understand IT either. Oops, I forgot. Now, fourth, there's no I in team. You know the old cliche, there is a me, but me is only part of it, right? You cannot and should not be expected to do this alone. If they want you to do it alone, well, it's probably time to look for a new job anyways. A difficult part is finding the right team members to work with. You know, as Edie mentioned, she happened to have a particular researcher who needed something. She knew if she went to the VP who had been there that she'd get some results, and she did. So you have to hand pick who are your allies and make sure you use them effectively. The next point is understand that solutions take money. Unfortunately, everything takes money, but you need to make the connection up front how the money that they're spending can help save money in the future. For example, you're not mailing your items anymore when you have a request for a researcher. You can use the email system, or you can even have a direct access for them. You may also need to think creatively about financing. As archivists and records managers, we have skills that are somewhat unique, but can be applied in other disciplines. Trade them, barter them, whatever way you want to use them, because sometimes you may find a situation where your IT department needs somebody to go out and document some processes because there's a new system that's going to be developed. We can do that because of our experience with looking at records, appraising records. Volunteer to do that, so maybe they'll volunteer some of their time to help you. Then also use the money you do receive both effectively and make sure you account for every single dollar that you spend.
If you have money left over, volunteer to give it back. Or say, you know, I have this money left over. Can we use this to be seed money for our next project? Next, learn as much as you can from your colleagues. You can do things like attending sessions like the one here today and some of the others that we've already had at the conference. Both at the national and regional conference level, there are more and more sessions like this. Join listservs like EREXL and either lurk, which is a good way if you don't want to be known, or ask questions. If you're not getting the answers you want, ask the question. There's plenty of people who are there to help, and you know, you may get a few people that say, well, why is someone asking that? Ignore them. Also, read the archival and records management literature and try and stay current on the latest projects and theories. Even if you're not going to apply the theory or the theories don't make sense, usually there's still one sentence in there that can help you guide a next project that you're trying to work on or give you a line that will make sense for somebody else you're trying to sell it to. Share what you have learned by publishing articles in the literature or presenting at conferences. This is an important thing. One of the things, the session came out of several conversations I had last year and overheard by small institutions who said, I don't know what I can do because I'm not NARA. I don't have the money. Well, there are things you can do. It's just a matter of trying to figure out and talking with people who have tried to do some of those already. Learn as much as you can from related groups. Attend web-based seminars from groups like AIM. These are often free. A session I was at earlier this week, someone said, but I think AIM's so closely connected to the industry. It doesn't matter. The more times you hear the same thing, that's a good kernel of truth. And so that's a good way to, in order to make sure you are getting and seeing what's going on. And if you're like me out in the middle of nowhere, it's too expensive to go to other workshops. So it's especially the free web seminars a good way to try and stay up with what's going on. And then you can also attend workshops and courses sponsored by groups like ARMA. ARMA has chapters in, I think, pretty much every state, or if you're along a border, there's chapters in Canada as well. They're a little bit more expensive, but if you're able to talk your organization into it, they're definitely a good choice. And then finally, read vendor literature and white papers. Same thing like with learning from the other groups. The more you hear, the more you see that's the same, you know it's stuff that's going in the right direction. And then vendors also offer free seminars on the web. You have to sit through 5-10 minutes of, here's what we're doing now. But then you can usually get an industry analyst or a consultant who's going to speak on a particular topic that you're never going to have a chance to hear or get their information without paying their fees. So, if you have any questions, here's all of our contact information. If you want to contact us personally, if you don't want to ask a question right now, we are going to open up the floor for questions. We do have a session in here right after this one is done at 2 o'clock. So if you have further questions, we can be available outside. But we will have to kind of shut down right at 2 o'clock. Okay, are there any questions for our panelists? Go ahead. Wait, I have to repeat the question because of the recording. The question is, how does the system that Edie has created handle email attachments?
Actually, it does handle all email attachments in multiple formats.
Okay. The question is, can everyone decide what emails go into the system, or is it just particular people within the organization?
What we've done, we have for the different regions a regional leadership team. We were charged with giving the regional leadership team the opportunity to select the personnel that will send and retrieve. For each region, there are probably 5 to 10 people who are sending. For home office staff, usually the vice president has access for sending and retrieving, but so does his administrative assistant.
Any other questions? Yes.
Benita from New York State, I'll ask the question you wanted to ask. Why was it so important to have the manual work?
Thank you.
Just a second. Why was it so important to have the manual work for Bonnie?
Okay,
One of the things that I hear repeatedly in my preliminary discussions with staff who are going to be taking on electronic records work is a lot of anxiety about doing it. And I want them to see that this is not rocket science, that if they have knowledge of Windows Explorer and some other basic things, that these are things that they can do. That's my short-term reason. My long-term reason is that as the number of records we take in and grow, grows, it's going to be harder and harder for us to do this manually. I do not want to be the only person telling senior management we need to invest some money in automating some of the tasks that we do. I want half a dozen people behind me.
Any other questions? Yes. Okay, the question is whether or not any of our panelists have been working with audio and video files and how they're handling the large sizes.
We actually do have a couple of video files. However, they're quite small. In fact, they fit on a single CD. I have format concerns about them, but at this time, size is not an issue.
And what we're doing at the company is, again, our document management system will handle those files. We're just loading them in the system right now and trusting the backup. I'm not liking that solution at this point, so that's on my radar for the next step.
And our emails, we have not received any of those attachments.
Yes?
I was curious, what document management system are you using at Aerospace?
Aerospace, it's an open text product called LiveLink. It's out of Ontario, Canada.
Mm-hmm. Well, right now,
the question is, how is Edie dealing with the backlog issues she addressed as a concern?
Right now, not all of our regions are using the email system. The ones that have done research with us are the ones that are most likely to really address that issue. I have actually been traveling around the world, going and helping people to upload those documents. Basically, I just highlight and send. But I do sit in Singapore or Jakarta or Taipei and do that. So part of it is that the hands-on being there, leading a discussion about why we should do this, has really benefited. We went from, after a year, 5 regions. We now have 8 regions. We went from, after 1 year, of having about 7,000 documents in the email system to having 25,000 emails and attachments in the system.
The question is you know, what kind of backup systems would be working the best instead of using CDs and DVDs at time because of the issues with their longevity? What are you doing now, and what are some of the options, including external hard drives, in order to use for backup systems?
Our storage station, as I mentioned, consists of a small server, 3 hard drives, RAID 5 data protection, and we produce backup copies for remote storage, or at least we will once IT installs the server, store copies of original bitstream and converted files on those hard drives and produce backup copies on LTO tape for remote storage.
And at the Aerospace Corporation, that's about the same thing that we're doing. We're working on setting up a complete mirrored server. We're bicoastal, so we've got the main service on the West Coast right now. I'm told that within the month that our second system, a mirror system, will be operational on this coast. In addition, we do a weekly tape backup that, again, goes to an off-site secure location. I'm not satisfied with it. That's why I'm asking a lot of questions at this conference.
And for the email system, it is our intention to actually FTP the information that we pull from the database per model and put it to microfilm. That has not been accomplished, although we have a test that we've done. Multiple formats have presented several problems, and so we are looking for a new vendor right now to help us deal with that.
Rick.
Mm-hmm. I guess I sold you short on that.
Yeah. Let me go ahead and repeat what Rick said. The concern is external hard drives will often crash just as much as the internal hard drives in your machine, so refreshing CDs on a regular basis might be the most viable option for long-term between those two. Is that correct, Rick? Yes, and more than one replication of that as well. You know, I'm dealing with that with my organization. They've been saving stuff on CDs since 1995. Of course, they didn't back up those CDs forever. And when I started, I made sure that they got backed up, but they had already lost one with all the documents that we had produced electronically from 1995 to 97. So, you know, those are certainly issues that we're all trying to address as far as, particularly when you're on a very small budget, what is the best form of storage and backup so that you've got your true archival savings for that. Any other questions?
Actually, I'd like to respond to that comment as well. As I mentioned in my presentation, I expect that every piece of hardware that we purchase today is going to be replaced. And as far as CD is concerned, I'm not so much concerned about the length of time that they're readable as the length of time that computers are going to come with CD drives. You know, we've already seen it with, you know, floppy disks, and, you know, who knew several years ago that flash memory was going to be the big thing. Mm-hmm. I think the big challenge is not so much the longevity of the media as, you know, the media's physical properties as it is media obsolescence.
But if your IT department wants to use a flash drive for backup,
yeah,
go for the external drive.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for attending our session.